And welcome, members. I've called this meeting of the Labor, Industry, Veterans, and Military Affairs Finance and Policy Committee to order. I would like to announce that this meeting is being held virtually and according to House Rule 10.01. And the meeting can be viewed on the House Public Information TV, which is available on the House website. As is custom with this committee, please rise and say the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. And Ms. Doyle, if you could take the roll.
Chair Eklund, excused. Vice Chair Zhang, excused. Representative Detmer.
Detmer, present.
Representative McDonald. Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Bliss.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Greenman.
Present.
Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Sundin.
Present.
Representative McDonald. And we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Doyle. And members, just for the record, I'm chairing the meeting till Representative Eklund, who's presenting a bill, gets back. And so I'll be running the meeting till he gets here. The next thing on our agenda is approval of the minutes. Representative Bliss, did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I've reviewed the minutes and I'd like to move them, please.
Representative Bliss moves approval of the minutes from the previous meeting of February 23rd. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Our minutes are approved.
Here, McDonald here.
And Ms. Doyle, you caught that. The man, Representative McDonald, is now here.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Get down here in the agenda. The first bill we have today is House File 792, Representative Majority Leader Winkler. And members, I will move that House File 792 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Welcome, Majority Leader Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I promise that I will not darken your door again this week, at least, and I don't have plans to come back to this committee this session, but you never know. House File 792 is, I think, shorter in page number than the amendment that I offered yesterday to House File 600. House File 792 provides a $400,000 grant for the Veterans Resiliency Project in 2022 and $400,000 in 2023, and makes that funding available on an ongoing basis for the base budget of the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs, requires a report back to the legislature on the work of the Veterans Resiliency Project. And members, these are incredible people doing amazing work on a shoestring. They have kept this project going and changed lives and saved lives. They can tell their story far better than I can. And Mr. Chair, I would ask that you go to the testifiers because I think you'll hear some pretty incredible testimony today.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. And I have a list of testifiers. The first on my list, and if I butcher your name, I apologize in advance. Eric Wixier. You're muted, sir. Yeah, yes. There you go.
Eric Wickheiser. So thank you very much. I'd like to welcome and thank you for this opportunity. We've got a lot of information, so if you could hold your questions, we would be appreciative. Our ask is simple. With volunteers and gifts, we have done incredible work with veterans, and with your help, we can do miracles. I'm Eric Wickheiser, board chair of Veterans Resilience Project and a Vietnam-era vet. 3 years after I left the service, I came to the realization that if my service job was ever called into action, the result would kill tens of thousands of people, and I simply could not handle that. Fortunately, I got help that was needed and recovered to that. Now, some vets experience trauma as not being able to get up to go out to work. Some push people away and they end up homeless, and some choose suicide as a way out of the pain. Fortunately, Veterans Resilience Project has found a way out. Our theme is conquering Minnesota veterans trauma with EMDR therapy. We are a nonprofit that has provided this EMDR therapy to veterans with PTSD and trauma symptoms, such as moral injury, since 2013. EMDR is recognized as the fastest and most effective treatment for trauma symptoms. We're unique because we are the specialized EMDR trainers for advanced training for therapists, which is specifically geared towards the military. The trained therapist can use this training also as an asset to help other community members. Big plus. To do our work, we collaborate and support many other organizations serving veterans throughout Minnesota. We're different than our partner, the VA, as we have 26 therapists located around Minnesota. We're 100% confidential, and we also take VA and non-VA qualified veterans. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to our director, Elaine Nguyen.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Nguyen. Please state your name for the record and proceed. You're muted.
Elaine Nguyen. I'm a psychologist and an EMDR approved consultant and presenter. And I want to go forward and ask the question, can we join together with $400,000 to help us continue our success? In 2005, the story goes, and it's true, I looked at young people coming back from Iraq, and I thought EMDR would be so good for this. I was already 10 years at a psychotherapist using this form of therapy. And I went everywhere asking people and trying to get several things almost happened and didn't. And it wasn't until 8 years later, 2012, 7 years later, 2012, when I looked at a movie and saw veterans who were in prison because they had trauma and reintegration problems from the military. And I knew again, I couldn't stop. And I went and I called EMDR Humanitarian Assistance Project. They had had a project and they had some money left. And before the conversation was over, the director said, look, come back in 2 weeks and give me a plan. So I did. I pulled together a group of veterans and veteran service people. I was a veteran spouse. I'm a veteran spouse. And so these folks came together and they were so quick and so willing and ready to do it. And they all had some interest in or had used EMDR. So we went forward and they said, okay, we got this small grant. You come next month to the big meeting and we'll sign the papers. We went ahead, 2013 and 14, we did a pilot project. That was just, I had signed on to do that. The data collected surprised even me. 74% of the veterans no longer had PTSD and 100% had improved symptoms. Now, Katie Homer's gonna talk today. She was one of those folks and she was, we had a Memorial Day 2016 article in the paper about the program and Katie was in it. And David Shulkin was on, USVA junior policy person at that time. And he later became a director of the National VA. And David saw this and he said, what is this? Why aren't we doing it? Why are we stopping other people from doing it? And he got excited and he moved and he was that kind of a leader inside the VA. And he sent to all of the VA medical centers a letter saying, we will all have at least one EMDR therapist at every VA medical center in the country. It didn't happen in 2 months. One of the articles says that, but that's okay. Later, it's been happening and it's all over the country. And the therapists in a lot of these places are just grateful to Minnesota because this got going here and it really affected their lives because the national then moved when this happened. There are three therapies that the Department of Defense and the VA nationally recommends. We are one of them. EMDR. Recent article in JAMA, Journal of American Medical Association, by a researcher from the VA says two of them are not coming up to the success rate. Well, we need to have more research about EMDR, but I told you what our data research said, and it squares with other people's work around the country, inside the military. There have been researchers in there. And we have built success. We have 25 advanced trained therapists, as Eric said. We are going to be focused on this upcoming money gives us chance to go even more, focusing on women vets. Military sexual trauma is continuing to be a problem. The suicide rate is very high, increasing again for women. It's very high with Vietnam vets. We saw only OIF and OEF veterans when we first started, and the other people from other eras came and said, why can't we do this? Well, sure enough, we said, we're opening to everybody. We don't ask what kind of a discharge you had. We don't have, because we know that sometimes can be part of the problem. And we will continue with that. We are continuing our advance to bring a strong look and work on historical trauma. We will be recruiting younger veterans or younger therapists, EMDR therapists, and we will be training at no cost the therapists from Brown, Black, and Native communities. And those folks will also be available to their own communities after that time, as will ours. We will be giving if things come up this summer that we need extra folks for, any veteran, of course, can come. Any first responder veteran can come to our organization and get help. Not only that, we will certainly, if somebody sets up another kind of triage of people who will work with the necessary trauma issues in the community, and that have been in the community or continuing to be, we would certainly pass that out so all of our therapists could take. You know, if 100 people take one client, that's a lot of people. So one veteran wrote a card when we started in 2012. And then, you know, they said there were 2 million people. Well, now some people say 6 million, 8 million who have used EMDR. There are 100,000 certified therapists around the world who use EMDR, and strong organization. One veteran wrote a card and it said, 2 million people have been helped by EMDR. Why not veterans? Are we going to join together with you and close this gap and really make the recovery welcoming veterans all the way home?
Thank you, Ms. Nguyen. The next person I have on my list is Jim Findlay. Findlay, you want to identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, my name is Jim Findlay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to be here. I've been working with VRP for several years now. I spent my career working with the state of Minnesota with veterans employment and education, and I have seen the results of the wrong treatment or no treatment with things like PTSD. As Elaine mentioned, there are untreated veterans in Minnesota, and it's hard to put a dollar value on what that costs, not only Minnesota, but also business in Minnesota. Again, our goal is to bring veterans all the way home to their communities, their families, and their workplaces. Recently, I read an article and it talked about the fact that 22 service members are dying by suicide every day nationally. The article was written in 2016. in February, just a couple of weeks ago, 5 years later, we're still losing 22 veterans a day to suicide. In Minnesota, it's about 100 veterans per year, or about 500 since 2016 to suicide. These are our children, our parents, our brothers, and our sisters. Excuse me. It's a kid that delivers your newspaper, and it's a kid that brings your groceries to your door. In 2019, 2 years ago, this body, Minnesota Legislature, stood up and made the first Saturday in October Veterans Suicide and Awareness Day. We applaud that, just the awareness. It seems though, as hard as we try, the solution continues to evade us. Could it be that due to current available systems are not effective? A recent article by Maria Steenkamp determined that many of the treatment models that we were using were not adequate and were not providing the desired outcome. The results show up in the statistics nationally and in Minnesota. Veteran suicide rate is 1.5 times higher than the general public. And for women, as Elaine mentioned, it's 2.2 times higher. We believe we have evidence-based solution in EMDR, and VRP has a plan to actualize it. Some of this gets down, and I'll close here. Veterans are mission-oriented, whether they're leaders or followers. They need something to drive for, to strive for. Things like teamwork and leadership, diversity, they learn new skills quickly, are all things that are highly desired by employers. But veterans have to be at the top of their game. And unless we get them to a point where they can deal with some of the things they experienced in the military, it's going to be hard for them to get back. I've placed over 2,000 veterans in jobs in my career with the state, and I have seen way too many more than once. And that's because they never seem to find a solution to what's at the bottom of their problems. So that's all I really have to say. This is no longer a veterans issue. I would suggest that this is also an economic development issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Findlay. The next person I have on the list is David Robb. And if you want to identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, this is David Robb. I'm also known as Colonel David Robb, retired. I spent 40 years in the military at Fort Snelling. I commanded the 785th Combat Stress Company, which is at Fort Snelling. And we were the first unit that came out in pursuit of the war in Iraq. I can tell you that stress is real. It's a silent killer. Our soldiers, our families, have been impacted, based on the data. It's difficult with all the things that are going on as we as we're seeing with the virus and veterans unemployment. And so my recommendation would be to continue to help us. There's one of the opportunities that I had was to serve with a Chaplain Bill from Fort Snelling. Some of you might know him. And I served with him in Iraq. Actually, I went to Command General Staff. But one of the things that I remember was that one of his last sermon that I heard before going into Afghanistan was a sermon on, it was very simple, "So help me God." He preached for about 30 minutes on So Help Me God. Those four words. And we're here asking for help. We're here begging for help. We are from Minnesota, yeah. And we know that there are some needs that VRP has shown that they could improve and have done. But the question is, what happens in the future? So I'm here to just advocate and be as strong as I can in trying to influence change, because we need your help. That's it. Bottom line. So help me. So help us, God. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rabe. The next on my list is Katie Helmer. Again, identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. My name is Katie Helmer. I am a 13-year veteran. I just got out about almost 2 years ago now. So 13 years, two combat tours. I first went to Kuwait and Iraq in 2009 and 10, and that is when I was kind of came back in a depression, realizing that, you know, life doesn't stop when you're gone. And I had a very, very hard time realizing and adjusting to that. And then not even a year and a half later, I was then deployed again to Afghanistan, where I did combat casualty liaison for the Army. And so I was working in the largest hospital in Afghanistan, in Bagram. And I was a liaison from the Department of the Army, where they were doing reports to families on their service members who had been injured while they were overseas. And so I saw all of my injuries. This was my first time being surrounded by like this traumatic stuff, and I was, you know, 23 years old, and I knew that I was gonna need help getting through this, because this was very traumatic to me. But it was a very rewarding career to have, because you kind of see what life is actually worth. And so when I came home, I knew I was gonna need help, and I got the help that I needed, just because from the way that I had reacted to coming home just a, you know, in 2010. And that is when I was referred to EMDR, and I was already having PTSD nightmares of terrorist attacks on our base that had happened, and all my other personal experiences that had happened during the deployments. So with EMDR, I was able to get over my PTSD issues, or at least I should say get over it, just be able to deal with it in a different way so that I could actually function and have a job when I came home, and get on with and get on with life and enjoy life and not be in such a depression and push people away. So EMDR has kind of helped me to be able to, even if I have those nightmares, I can wake up, I calm myself down, and I go back to sleep, and it's not this all night thing where I can't go back to sleep. And certain scenarios that would bring on anxiety and other things, I can be in those situations and not have them cause the anxiety that it used to have, where it used to just shut me down. And so it's been able to give me a life, and right now I'm pursuing my career in college, and I have a very great job as a center supervisor, and I'm able to work with people, which is what I've always kind of done, and I do it in a great way. And so EMDR, hopefully with this bill, will be able to touch many more people, being that I was only in the very beginning with the research. And so now that we have the research to back it, hopefully it'll help many more people. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Helmer. Next I have on my list is Olivia Janice. Welcome to the committee, and again, state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the body. My name's Olivia Janice, and I am a licensed clinical professional counselor. I have been practicing for over 30 years, and I got trained in EMDR in about 2004, 2005. Today, I was asked to come and speak with you. I'm really feel honored to share this space with people who've really got the lived experience and who can do better than just about anybody to talk about what it means to free oneself of the experiences that we've had in the past that hold us or hijack us so that it prevents us from living how we want to live today. And one of the things that I want to do is give you just a little snapshot about what EMDR therapy is and how it's different from some of the talk therapies that are available that do a very good job of what they do. But we really believe that this is the best way to handle what I see as the need to metabolize experience, that when we are dealing with trauma, what we're really talking about is having to finish the work of taking in the experience, find meaning from it, and then being able to move forward. As human beings, it does seem to be one of our tasks to experience, learn from our experience, and move on to the next experience. But when we have been faced with something that, as a colleague of mine says, an experience that goes beyond the pale of our own existence, you know, our systems get kindled. For people, when we're faced with that kind of experience, one of the first things that I hear people talking about, one of the most common things, is that need to say no. I got to get through this. I really can't deal with this right now. I have to get through this. But what that does is set into motion disruption of the regular process. Now, I'm sure that all of you can talk about, let's just say, going to the store. You know how to get to the store. You know what roads that you have to take. You know where the stop signs are. And you know where you have to be careful if you're going through a school zone or a neighborhood that where there are a lot of children that are playing. But you don't remember every single moment, every single car that comes through, every single event that happens, everything, single sound, sight, smell, every idea, every thought. You don't, because we don't need it. That's because we have metabolized that experience of going to the store to the point where we know what we need to know. When we have a trauma, that gets interrupted. And so the body, our central nervous system, holds on to every bit of data because we don't know what it is that we don't need yet. We haven't gone through that digestive process or that metabolizing of that experience. The other thing is that where it's held in the body is a part of the brain that doesn't have a time chip. There's no chronology there. So everything is about the present moment. I don't have something that's synthesized, that's organized, that's integrated. I'll have separate sounds, sights, smells, emotions, pictures, beliefs that are not integrated in any kind of way. So I literally don't have the ability to even have a memory yet. We talk about traumatic memory and working through traumas, but the reality is we don't have a memory yet. What we're really doing in EMDR is to help people assimilate, associate, metabolize these experiences so that in the end, what we have is a memory of something that happened without the power to hijack us or grab us, and without that riptide from the past that pulls us back to something we've already survived. And because of this, this work is so effective. It's so effective, especially for veterans, because veterans are resilient and trained for distress. Veterans know how to do this. We just don't have the instruments haven't been available. They are now. We have what we need. We have the tools we need. Just to end on, just really briefly, it's not data. I have anecdotally, I worked with a client yesterday. I worked with this client for just under a year. And the client informed me yesterday that they're done. They have been symptom-free for over 3 weeks. And they honestly believe that they were done. And they thought they were done last week, but they didn't want to say that yet because they weren't quite sure. But we went through all the process of determining, is everything at neutral? And for this client, everything is at neutral. They finished their work in less than a year. This was a client that had been carrying trauma for decades, finished in less than a year, is moving on to be able to go forward with their lives, with their dreams, to be productive, to be able to be part of the community again. So with that, I'm going to leave you all. Thank you for your work. And thank you, especially Veterans Resiliency Project, because your work is value is beyond measure. So, Igwich.
Ms. Janice, I got one question before we go to the next testifier. Everyone's talking about EMDR, and I know that's an acronym for something. What does the acronym stand for? So we get it on the record.
Okay. The acronym stands for, I'm sorry, the computer, my internet is freezing off and on, so I didn't mean to interrupt if I did.
No, you didn't.
Okay. EMDR stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And the woman that started this is named Francine Shapiro. She named it that because that's literally how she found the physical part of the work to be helpful in metabolizing the emotional experience that we have, because our emotions are physical. You know, we know how we feel by what's happening in our body. However, the real issue is about bilateral stimulation, that back and forth, which she started with eye movements because that's what worked for her. If she had to call it anything today, she would not call it EMDR because we're not limited to eye movements.
Thank you. I just wanted to, everyone's been saying the acronym, and I just want to get it on the tape what it actually was so that the lay people out there can understand it. Thank you. Mm-hmm. The next person on the list is Tom McKenna, and then we'll go to questions. Mr. McKenna, identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name's Tom McKenna, and my story is probably not unlike many other veterans. I was in the Marine Corps. They trained us very well for the combat theater, for what will go on in there. Mental conditioning there, and what they couldn't and didn't train us for was what happens afterwards, what happens that night, what happens the next day when that person you patrol is now missing, what happens a year from then or 5 years from then when on Christmas you think about how their family's feeling. None of those things were available, and you necessarily bottle them up. You cannot let those things interfere in things when you're in the midst of combat. You can't. You'll get people killed or yourself. But and so I, like many others, just bottled it up, and it didn't come out until many years later. And when it did, it was bad. Floodgates. And I was at the point of suicide, and I was going to make one more phone call because I didn't want to die, but I had the pain, I needed it to stop. And that call was to Elaine, and she called me back within an hour and had me hooked up with a therapist within a week. And I've been through talk therapies at the VA. I still go to the VA, but EMDR was the one who got to the root of a situation rather than treating symptoms. And that was the amazing thing about it. My therapist was amazing, and it got it got to the root so we could pull it out and look at it. My perception of what had happened was not necessarily what had happened, but it was what my brain had filed. EMDR gave me the opportunity to take it out, look at it, and see where I thought maybe I had fault, maybe I didn't. Maybe the things that I considered monstrous that I had done, maybe were just exactly what I was trained to do. And it was just an amazing process. And so, like I said, my VA psychiatrist recommends that I go through it again, actually. Fully endorses EMDR, but the VA Minneapolis only has one person trained in EMDR. So you have to go outside to find it. And what has happened since, although it's not perfect, I still have to use my tools. I still have to get, make sure that I take care of myself. But because of my experience at the EMDR, my wife and I were able to start our own nonprofit. And now we see the need. We serve veterans every day. And we need the option to be able to refer them to EMDR, because what we see is PTSD in the mind, but so often what's killing us and causing the suicide rate is what's in the soul and in the heart. Those things we just can't make sense of. And so we need this alternative therapy to help go there. The VA can't. It's not their fault. They just can't. EMDR can and does. And so I'm already a minute over, so I apologize, but I'm kind of passionate about this. I just want to thank VRP for just giving me the opportunity to respond so quickly when I was in crisis, and then to continuing to battle through, and now hopefully get some funding underneath them. And like I said, at our place, we would love to be able to refer vets to EMDR and VRP. So thank you. And thanks for listening for the extra minute and a half. And please, if there's help to be given, these people deserve it.
Thank you, Mr. McKenna. And I'm told that Ben Johnson from the VA would like to speak. So, Mr. Johnson, if you can identify and make a few short comments.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, my name is Ben Johnson. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. I am not a psychologist or psychiatrist. I'm not a trained therapist. I'm here only to comment on the position of the agency on this particular bill. We're not discounting the potential efficacy of the therapy. And I've been fortunate to speak with Elaine and Eric frequently over the past couple of years to discuss ways in which we could support their efforts to expand access to EMDR. The challenge for us is only that the focus of this funding on one particular modality or form of therapy to the potential exclusion of others. Just wanted to highlight for members of the committee that the state of Minnesota supports veteran service organizations through grants each year, and annual grants to the veteran service organizations total less than the amount identified here, $353,000 for 7 veteran service organizations who offer a lot of services to veterans. We spend about $250,000 a year on Minnesota CORE program, which is through Lutheran Social Services as the grant recipient for that, and $750,000 each year to the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, which helps with housing for veterans, but also helps with supportive services, helps with various other methods of serving veterans. So again, thank you all. All the testifiers for the information and for the background. Thank you, Representative Winkler, for bringing this important bill forward and for helping identify this issue in our community. From our perspective, I just wanted to make sure that the members of the committee were aware that our biggest concern really is we understand what the budget fight looks to be, and we wanted to make sure that that the dollars that are being spent to serve veterans are serving as many veterans as possible. 312,000 veterans in the state of Minnesota. And just wanted to get that on the record, Chair Nelson, and Representative and Testifiers, thank you.
Thank you, sir. And I've got questions. I've got Representative Detmer, then Representative Berg, and then Representative Raleigh. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know the Military Action Group has heard from this group in the past couple years, and there's been as everybody knows on this committee and around the state, that I'm a very big supporter of our veterans programs and our various different veterans groups. I do have a concern. You know, we're talking about $800,000 here, and I know that $800,000 is going to be part of the veterans committee budget. If you take a look at that, but some of the questions that were brought up the MAG meeting were not really answered. And, you know, I have a couple questions here. Basically, how specifically would this appropriation money be used? You know, what does the budget look like for this organization?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, the budget has been provided to you. A detailed budget has been provided to you through the committee administrator, and you can review that. And if there are specific questions, I'm sure Ms. Nguyen could answer them, or any of the other leaders from Veterans Resiliency Project.
Yeah,
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have the budget in front of me, and I'm just looking at it. I know in the past, you're looking at donation gifts of about $35,000. And then the state funding looks like they've projected their budget at $394,000. So you're looking at total income about $429,000. Your executive director is going to be paid $54,000. The bookkeeper and the staff executive assistant is $57,000. So salaries there of about $111,000. The veteran care looks like about 200 veterans annually, $149,000. You have two outreach coordinators at $93,000. And then you have rent, small office, insurance equipment at $12,000, website materials at $14,000. And fundraising, legal, and accounting expenses at $15,000. So that makes up your $394,000 for a year. So, and I know Mr. Johnson, Ben Johnson from MDVA did point out that, you know, the amount of money that we spend on our veterans programs and how we can make those dollars last and also work with the most veterans possible. I'm not quite sure if this program is going to accomplish that goal. I have another question here. How is the EMDR measured when you're treating a soldier? How do you measure that?
Representative Winkler, or would Ms. Nguyen be better to answer that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, I think you outlined the budget pretty clearly and the number of people treated and the very modest costs. I'd like to point out that this work has been done so far on a volunteer basis and scrapping together funds, and it has, according to at least one testifier here, saved a life. So sometimes it's not a question of how many people are served, but whether you're serving people who have no other better place to go. And so for me, of course, the budget discussion coming up is a separate matter, and what we're doing here today is laying over a bill to consider for funding. And so that conversation will continue as you know what your budget target is. And to your second question, I would refer to Ms. Nguyen or one of the other testifiers.
Ms. Nguyen, if you can quickly.
We had a very well-structured in the pilot project. We had certain kinds of forms that are used by all veteran organizations. We had the mentorship of therapists who were also involved in the Navy, the Marines, the Army who helped us with that. We can pull that out. It takes a lot to put together a data collection or a research project. There are some funds available to that. We'd love to do that again. We'd like to do comparisons with other forms of therapy. So it's very well structured, the way that therapy. The one thing that we have that's rather unique, has a lot of narrative data, is what is your evaluation of EMDR and the EMDR therapist? And another part of it that's we have added this year, talking about Jim Finley's discussion about work, is what kind, in the beginning, what kind of job have you had, and what kind of business or job, what are you doing? And then afterward, right after the program and 6 months after, randomly, we hear always very positive comments coming from veterans.
Mr. Chair, Representative Depper, and again, this question to Ms. Nguyen, how are the EMDR results measured? And I know, and have you been affiliated with like the University of Minnesota or the Mayo Clinic? Are they part of your research, or?
We would love that.
Miss Nguyen.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
We would love that. We would love to work with them, certainly. And we were, the person who analyzed the results was the research supervisor at Alina.
Mr. Depper, one more question so I can move on to, and maybe we can get back to you.
Yeah, so what I've heard, and what I heard back last year with the MAG meeting, which has all the different veterans groups there at that meeting, is that right now you're not associated or affiliated with like the University of Minnesota or Mayo Clinic or any other medical associations. Am I correct?
That's Ms. correct. Nguyen. We're a nonprofit.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Time and again in this committee, we are both moved and inspired by the stories of our veterans. We recognize that we don't do enough for them. Representative Detmer, I appreciate your service, the service of your twins at West Point, and I appreciate your predilection for fiscal responsibility. However, as somebody who receives EMDR therapy for my own trauma that is nowhere near what our veterans suffer, and hearing the testimony, the courageous, raw, and vulnerable testimony that we've heard today, the fact that we're trying to place a cost on the very survival of people who have served this country, who keep us free, is appalling, number one. We'll find the money because we value human lives. We'll find the money because we value healing. This bill gives support to an organization that has been doing yeoman's work to heal the most patriotic members of our society, the people that give up everything to protect what we hold dear. Thank you to the author for bringing this forward. I can't imagine a more honorable bill to pass.
Thank you, Ms. Burke.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Burke.
My name was mentioned there.
Quickly, Representative Detmer.
And, you know, it just, sometimes I wonder, just because we're questioning the validity of a program, and My question was, have they sought the research and the support of, say, the Mayo Clinic or the University of Minnesota, and have they brought some experts in to verify what they're doing? I think that's a very good question when we're talking about our veterans. And in terms of their budget, there wasn't nothing wrong with looking at their budget. And so I take a little offense that just because I ask questions, that's what this committee is all about, is asking questions and getting information, as we did in the military action group, the which has all nine federally recognized veterans groups in the state of Minnesota. So we have to ask those questions. Thank you.
Representative Raleigh, you were next on my list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The report of the legislature that's in this bill, can you expand on what's going to be the outcome expectations of it? Because what I want to make sure is as we're serving our veterans, and by the way, just so the committee and the people know, I am a service-connected disabled veteran, 8 years active duty, United States Army Infantry. Sorry, Mr. Chair?
No, I just continue. Sir.
Oh, Roger. The question that I've got is on the reporting side of things, I'd like to dig a little, and I know we don't have a lot of time, but I would ask that the author expand a little bit about the reporting that's going to be delivered as a result of this, of serving these veterans. Things like how many veterans were served, and then specifically outcome-based evidence for that. And then also, just as a suggestion, if that report could be written up and then submitted to peer-reviewed journals, I think it would do a lot to help the case here. Mr. Chair.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Raleigh. I think enhanced reporting is perfectly acceptable, and I'm happy to get into greater detail with you. I would also recommend that you actually read the materials that were distributed to the committee, not saying you didn't, but all members, to read the materials, which I think addresses the underlying research supporting the therapy and the results. It's well worth the time. And I don't know about submitting to a peer-reviewed journal. I'm not aware of the legislature requiring grant recipients to do that in the past. And I'm not sure that with a budget that we're talking about, they would have the capacity to develop a report ready for JAMA. But I think some further detail in reporting, if you're interested, is something we could work out.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very satisfied.
Thank you. I see no further hands up. Well, there was one up that went down. With that, I'll renew my motion that House file. Before I do that, Representative Winkler, do you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I just want to thank you for your time and listening to the testimony of people who have been changing lives and saving lives. And I would urge the committee to consider state funding to allow that work to continue.
And so with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 792 be laid over for possible inclusion. And members, with that, we'll go to our next bill. The bill's laid over. The next bill we have on our agenda is House File 300. Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, can you hear me?
I can hear you, yes.
I don't know if you can see me because I don't see myself, but that's...
I can see you also, so...
Okay. What? I'm sorry, Chair. What bill are we going to do first?
I got House File 300.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the Job Committee. This is our flag bill.
1 second, Ms. Hewitt. Representative, I'll move that House File 300 be referred to the General Register. So, thank Representative, you. Hewitt, go on and explain the bill. I've heard this a couple of times.
Yeah, you have. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. Many of you that sat in this committee last year heard this bill. This is a very personal bill to me, and it should be personal to all of us. This bill here awards the flag on the top of the Capitol to a first responder family, a soldier, a police officer, and other first responders that die in the line of duty in the state of Minnesota. This bill has been presented in the last session. We came back, we tweaked it, we worked with the Senate on this. We now have it where we want it. I believe there is an amendment too, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hewitt, there's the A1 amendment. I'll move the A1 amendment, members. You want to explain the amendment and what it does, how it changes the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It basically takes all cost out of the bill. With overwhelming, this had gotten really popular. I got multiple calls and multiple individuals asking if they can give money to get this program going. With that response, we took the money out of the bill and basically now we feel we could do it just off of donations and get the program at least piloted, going, and the legislators can take a look at it in a year from now or so, or down the road.
So members of the author's amendment, all in favor of the author's amendment, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it, the bill's amended. And I see Representative Eklund, Chair Eklund is back. I will hand the gavel back to Mr. Chair Eklund. I hope your bill went well in Commerce.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. The amendment has been adopted.
Yes.
To your bill is amended, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Chair Eklund. I believe we have two testifiers here that would like to testify for the bill. Could we have them come up now?
First testifier on the list is Sean Storman, Commander, Minnesota EMS Honor Guard. Mr. Storman, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Sean Storman, and like you said, Mr. Chairman, I'm the Commander of the Minnesota EMS Honor Guard. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and guests. On behalf of the Minnesota EMS Honor Guard and the EMS services and the EMS individuals, we fully support this bill. Personally, since 2017, Minnesota has lost five EMS providers in the line of duty. And I've presented four of those flags to family members. And I can personally tell each and every one of you that those family members, that is the one item that they hold on to after the fact. And like I said, we fully support this bill, and it'd be a fitting tribute for those that have fallen. Thank you for your time. I'll entertain any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Sturman. Please stick around. Next up on the test fires is T. John Cunningham, President, Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association. Mr. Cunningham, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Cunningham. I'm the fire chief in the city of Brooklyn Park. I'm also president of the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association. I certainly do appreciate this effort as a firefighter, as a fire chief, and as a Minnesotan that we recognize and honor those our military vets and those that have died in public service, serving their communities locally as public safety professionals in the line of duty. From the fire service side, if you look out, when you get back to meeting in person, right outside your window at the Capitol grounds on our Fallen Firefighters Memorial, we've recognized 228 fallen firefighters since 1881. I've been involved since 2011 in various capacities at the annual Fallen Firefighters event at the Capitol. And I can tell you, as was mentioned, it's a very humbling experience, a very emotional when you hand off that flag to a family, a survivor, family member, someone that's died in the line of duty, and they appreciate that. And I realize from a technical standpoint of adding this language in and ensuring that those flags are flown and passed on to our survivor families. But it certainly means a lot, and something that as the Minnesota Fire Service, we support this effort and we appreciate it.
Thank you, Chief Cunningham. Member questions, Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've had the opportunity to speak with Representative Hewitt on this bill. As a former EMT myself, as Representative Hewitt is an EMT, and having performed over 1,100 burials in Arlington National Cemetery, where I laid to rest my brothers and sisters in full military honors, I want to speak in absolute favor of this. It's the right thing to do, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Raleigh. Any other member questions? Representative Hewitt, final thoughts. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, just question, Representative Hewitt, good bill. Curious as to the donations. You mentioned now you took the fiscal financial part out of the bill, but we'll accept donations, which I think is a fine idea. But how does that look
How do they donate, to who keeps track of that? And is it just one incident at a time? So you can just share on that a little bit.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Chair and Representative McDonald. Administration will be setting up that program after, and they're going to absorb the cost to set up the program. And then you'll be told where you can actually donate the money, and then they'll determine how much they have in the account to start the program up. My feeling is this could happen real soon. So a lot of actually legislators want to donate to it. So I'm really excited about it. We're getting it going. An administration actually likes this now, so I think we're good to go. Does that kind of fulfill what you're asking, Representative McDonald?
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hewitt, that fulfills the question, the desired question. Thank you.
Any other member questions? Representative Hewitt, final comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In 1970, I was 5 years old. I answered the door that day, and my life changed. I was told my brother was not coming home from Vietnam. The one memory I remember in that whole 2 week period, because back then it took bodies 2 weeks to get back to their families, was the flag that was presented to my parents at Fort Snelling. This is very important. We need to get it done this year. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. I renew my motion that House File 300 as amended be referred to the General Register. Ms. Doyle, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Yes.
Eklund, aye. Vice Chair Zhang, excused. Representative Detmer.
Detmer, aye.
Detmer, aye. Representative McDonald.
McDonald, aye.
McDonald, aye. Representative Berg.
Aye.
Berg, aye. Representative Bliss.
Aye.
Bliss, aye. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Edelson, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Poston.
Poston, aye.
Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, aye.
Raleigh, aye. Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Sundin, aye. And there are 12 ayes, 0 nays.
Representative Hewitt, you are on your way to the General Register. Thank you. Next bill on the agenda is also from Representative Hewitt. I will move that House File 37 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. We have the A1 author's amendment. I will move the author's amendment. Representative Hewitt, would you like to explain the amendment to have or have nonpartisan staff do it?
Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, see, I have a concern regarding the amendment. Would you like me to address that now or after he introduces it?
Representative McDonald, we'll let the bill author introduce his amendment, and then we'll talk about before we vote on it. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for hearing this bill. This bill basically is doing the same thing we did last summer.
Representative Hewitt, can you explain the A1 amendment first, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. Actually, I'm going to have the staff explain the A1 amendment because that just came in. It came in last night. So if it wouldn't be a problem, Chair, I'd like to have staff explain it.
Ms. James? Ms. James, if you could explain the amendment, please.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, the A1 amendment modifies two dates in the bill. So the report from the Department of Labor will now be due on January 15th. I don't have the amendment right in front of me, but I believe it's January 15th, 2022. And then January 1st, 2022, excuse me. And then there will not be an updated report due. And then also modifies the sunset or expiration date to May 1st of 2022.
Thank you, Ms. James. Representative McDonald, to your question on the A1 amendment before we vote on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I speak on behalf of the minority in our group here. We don't have an objection of the amendment itself, but how it was handled. It clearly was not in part of the 24-hour rule. I think, as a matter of fact, it was just presented at 11 o'clock today, many hours before your 24-hour rule. So we do have a problem with that. It certainly is not very transparent for the minority and especially the public in general who are paying attention, no matter what the amendment states. Because again, we don't have any difficulties with the particular technical amendment, but that in which how it was handled. So we just hope that you duly note that and have a little discrepancy and leniency on the minority should we get an amendment in late. But that said, we really do need to stick to the 24-hour rule for certain transparency. Good for the minority and good for the public who is trying to follow along with the bills. So I just let you know that we do object with this 24-hour rule being broken for this amendment. And I just want to get your thoughts on that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. And the 24-hour rule is generally in place for all our committee hearings, but it has been waived in the past. And the chair is certainly cognizant of that in the event that we have bills coming from the minority party that we're going to hear. We will do our best to be flexible. That is part of the reason why we're laying this bill over at this point in time, because of that fact that the amendment came in late.
Mr. Chair, I know you are a man of your word, so we'll take note of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. Any other questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed, say nay.
Nay.
Motion. Thank you. Motion carries. Representative Hewitt, please explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill basically gives our educators and our school workers the same coverage of work comp that we gave to our first responders and frontline workers this summer. It's impossible for our educators not to have contact with their students. And this bill will give them that guarantee as they're returning to the classroom right now that we have their back, we have their six on this, that when they go into the classroom, they don't have to worry that if they do get COVID from a student or from another individual in the school, that they are going to be covered. We need to give them a security blanket. They need all the help they can get and all the support they can get right now. And that's what this bill will do, is to make sure that if for some reason they do come down with COVID, that it presumes that they got it in school and that they are going to be covered for that care. I stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Representative Hewitt. We do have some testifiers. Kirk, can I? If I blow your name here, I'm sorry. Schneiderwin, Executive Director of Minnesota School Boards Association. Mr. Chair, Schneiderwin, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Eklund, thank you very much for the introduction. You did a great job of pronouncing my name, so appreciate that. So first I want to say, you know, since our districts have been in various modes of instruction since March of last year, we, our staff, board, superintendents, support staff, bus drivers have all done a great job of putting our students first. And I think that's really, really important as we discuss this bill in front of us today. And we know that the environment has changed too. We know that where we were in March and even in November and today, with the numbers decreasing and more students going back to school, things have changed certainly. However, by the same token, we appreciate the earnest and honest intentions of the drafters and Representative Hewitt on the bill. We strongly believe that House File 37, if it becomes law, may undo many of our workers' compensation norms and put in play some uncertainties and costs that may be felt for decades to come. As such, we want to raise some concerns and some observations of this new proposed law as it is written. To be clear, we are not asking to take away employee benefits that currently exist. Workers' comp, health, medical, all of that is still in play. So while we acknowledge that this statute was amended in 2020 to allow a presumption change with respect to certain categories of Minnesota workers, we do not see the same practical or legal need for our education workers. While the exposures and risks are similar, we believe they are, in the bigger picture, materially different. The science really seems to tell us that. Secondly, while it seems that no one may ever be able to absolutely say that the risks from COVID-19 are completely gone, the COVID-19 exposure risk to our education employees appear to have become significantly more manageable. Third, with the presumption switch, school districts and our workers' compensation insurers will only be able to appropriately deny an education worker's COVID-19 compensation claim by proving or rebutting that the cause of COVID-19 positivity was effectively from a source other than the workplace. As this bill is currently written, let's consider an example of how this might apply. You have 10 school employees out celebrating a 40-year birthday. They catch COVID from the restaurant employee, and 10 of the employees come back to work and are able, after they've been tested and confirmed with COVID, are able to claim that the COVID was presumed to be at the workplace. So in this example, there could be great difficulty establishing the true cause of that illness. Also under this law, with this type of presumption, there is adamantly a significant burden shift requiring school districts to spend more time and resources investigating, analyzing, and evaluating the facts and circumstances to rebut the presumption. That likely raises costs and expenses in and of itself. Common sense suggests that with this type of presumption change, workers' compensation expenses and costs will likely go up, depending on the ultimate frequency, duration, and severity of the claims. With most school districts already experiencing budget constraints, adding another likely direct increase in expenses and costs from workers' comp seems we are certain will impact the school district's bottom line. How much workers' compensation costs might be impacted with the presumptions change? Keep in mind that generally speaking, once a workers' compensation claim has been accepted, the medical exposure on that claim is accepted for the life of the worker. In legislative terms, the tails of these claims can last from 20 to 30 to up to 50 years. A second concern is the issue on the retroactivity. In addition to the other concerns that I have mentioned, the truly significant concern is in this bill is the retroactive applicability. First, when bills are written like this, it opens up a lot of difficult variables and uncertainties. This retroactive effect compounds those difficulties. We respectfully suggest that we should be trying to reduce these kinds of risks, not perhaps expand them. Most all workers' compensation claims and injuries very frequently are lowered when they are addressed right away, as opposed to retroactively months later. The nearly nine-month retroactive date set forth in this bill, much like a normal late reporting with typical workers' comp claims, quite possibly impairs a school district's ability to rebut the investigation, take away any chance of suggesting potentially supportive medical treatment or nurse case management alternatives, or it would also negate any return to work or light duty options. We also believe that we all need to be careful to not presume that the retroactive effect date of this bill was not merely incidental or immaterial in nature. We respectfully ask if hypothetically the number of worker compensation claims reported and the amounts paid for are nearly the same for COVID-19, why do we need a retroactive date, let alone a presumption to change it altogether? The bill encompasses all employees regardless of their instructional model. At a minimum, we would suggest that the language be added to make it clear that it would only apply to employees or contracted employees who have been working in person in the school buildings or who have had other direct contact with students and families, perhaps through home visits, and not apply to staff who were or are working 100% full-time from their homes. In addition, relative to specific language in the bill as written, we call your attention to the third clause on line 1.15. Specifically, one reading this clause is that it applies to any other person providing services to students under a contract with the school district charter or non-pub. This suggests that perhaps nearly every employee or nearly every vendor working with the school district will be subject to the presumption. Is that the intent? If so, that potentially adds yet another cost and uncertainty to schools as well. And quite possibly the vendors may need to raise their prices to cover the potential increase in their worker comp costs. Ultimately, we think it's fair to ask, what is the goal? And Representative Hewitt's been very clear. We generally see this bill is disrupting some of our norms in the workers' comp space, making it more challenging for our districts to really build back better. And that really challenges the board's ability to govern and manage the district and potentially reduced student opportunities. Mr. Chair, Representative Hewitt, thank you for the opportunity today.
Thank you, Mr. Schneiderwein. And to our testifiers, we have four testifiers that are against this bill. If the details that have been covered that are your objections, please don't repeat them because we have 14 minutes left to finish this committee. Aaron Cocking, President CEO of Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Mr. Cocking, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 37 this afternoon. For the record, Aaron Cocking, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. When COVID-19 struck last March, nobody knew what the following year was going to hold. Nobody knew what the ramifications of the virus were going to be. Nobody knew the extent to which it would impact our workforce and our everyday lives. In those initial weeks, the Insurance Federation worked with legislators and other groups to establish a workers' compensation presumption for frontline workers who contracted COVID-19. In the past year, we have come to understand more about the virus, and drug companies were able to develop several vaccines in record times. That presumption was needed because during a time of uncertainty, it got our first responders, nurses, doctors, and others to work. Things have changed. The situation over the past 323 days has changed. February 24th, 2021 is much different than April 7th, 2020, the date that presumption bill was passed. We now know much more about who the virus impacts and how it is transmitted. The workers' compensation system is designed to protect employees who are injured or made ill within the course and scope of their employment. Workers' compensation is not designed and should not be used as health insurance. One of the issues we have seen since the original COVID-19 presumption law was passed last year is the number of presumptive class employees who contract the disease elsewhere yet are paid from the work comp system. Governor Walz, in his address statewide on the evening of November 18th, said this, quote, "The healthcare workers are not getting it, COVID-19, in the facilities. They're getting it in the community by community spread. Either they stopped at a friend's house after work to watch a football game, or they went and spent time in a restaurant, or they were close to someone for too long a period of time. That's where they're getting it, and they're taking it in," close quote. In fact, a study by Mayo Clinic found that 93% of their employees got the virus from the community, not at work. Unfortunately, many of these claims were paid out of the work comp system. If only 7% of nurses who had contact with COVID-19 patients get it at work, how much less will that be for education professionals? The work comp system should pay for employees who are infected within the course of their employment, not from community spread. And that is what is happening currently. The data reported during the Work Comp Advisory Council this morning, as well as data that was shared with me, shows that education personnel work comp claims are being filed, being investigated, and valid claims are being paid, while ordinary diseases of life, meaning community spread claims, are being denied. That is how the system should work. In addition to adding people who did not become sick at work to the work comp system, we share with Kirk about the significant problems with the retroactivity of the bill. And per your request, Mr. Chairman, I won't go into that any further since that's already been covered. But finally, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we question the need for this presumption in light of the vaccines that are being administered across the state. As of a week ago, it was reported that 25% of all educators have been vaccinated. Governor Walz said he expected, quote, "the bulk of educators," close quote, to get their first doses by March 8th, which is a week from Monday. If that is the case and the governor's rollout to teachers continues successfully, this bill becomes more and more unnecessary, especially with the legal problems associated with the retroactive nature of this bill. Our work comp system is designed to take care of injured workers, which it does on a daily basis. Adding yet another presumption, in our opinion, is not the right answer. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the time. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Cocking. Next up, Lisa Hunninghake, Wilshire Park Elementary School at St. Anthony, Minnesota. Ms. Hunninghake, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Lisa Honeyhake, and I'm a library media specialist for Wilshire Park Elementary School in St. Anthony, Minnesota. I'm one of tens of thousands of educators and school employees who have been in classrooms, lunchrooms, and school buses for months, educating and caring for our students during the COVID-19 pandemic. Back in August, I agreed to take over teaching a kindergarten classroom as our district was bringing back as many kindergarten and first grade students as possible for face-to-face learning. 2 months later, I moved to a first grade classroom as our district reconfigured the in-person learning structure. On November 23rd, we were to abandon face-to-face instruction and return to distance learning. The week before that, I started feeling I was developing a cold. I talked to our school nurse and ended up going to the convention center for a COVID test. My class and I had to quarantine immediately. On November 19th, my test came back positive. The school nurse followed up with me afterwards and shared that her contact tracing revealed one of my students had tested positive prior to me contracting the virus, and yet the family never revealed the results to the school. As I continued to quarantine, my symptoms got worse. I started having pain in the left side of my lungs and cramping in the back of my right leg. On November 27th, just after Thanksgiving, my cough worsened and I was directed to an urgent care clinic. I had called our nurse and she sent me forward to the urgent care. From there, I was sent directly to the hospital. After multiple tests, I was diagnosed with COVID pneumonia. I was put on oxygen and struggled to sleep through that first night. After a number of complications, I eventually went home on December 1st. I was lucky. A substitute had to cover my class from November 23rd to January 4th, a total of 15 work days while I recovered. Teachers and other school employees are essential and are not only risking their lives and safety in the midst of a global pandemic, but also their ability to keep their families afloat and put food on the table. Providing workers' compensation for school staff members who unfortunately contract COVID-19 in the workplace gives them a much-needed safety net. They can heal and keep their students and colleagues safe without fear of missing a paycheck. I'd like to thank the committee and members of the public for listening to my experience today and ask that you support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Honeyhake. Next up, Dan Payan, Minnesota Association of School Business Officials. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Dan Payan. I'm the Director of Finance and Operations for South Washington County Schools. Also chair of the Legislative Committee for MASBO. In respect to your request, Kirk hit pretty much most of the points we had. I just want to point out just quickly a few financial things. Workers' compensation premiums are a major expense for school districts. Our premium in South Washington County Schools alone is $1.2 million a year. The drivers of these premiums are experience rates, known as mod rates. Many questions come from this bill. How will this affect our mod rates? Are we going to see a huge increase in premiums? Are we going to see increase in premiums of the contractors? I'll just leave it with this, that it's been a very difficult financial year for most school districts. Funds have been drained, providing essential worker care, providing meals to all, increasing technology resources. Enrollment losses have reduced aid to many, many school districts, and we just feel passing a bill like this will increasing our worker comp costs, driving up our rates will be detrimental to school districts. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Payan. Next up is Scott. I won't get this one. Wojtyciak, Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers. And I'm sorry, sir, for brutalizing your name.
Mr. Chair, you did a very good job. I appreciate the opportunity. My name is Scott Wojtyciak. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers and as a Minnesota employer. And I thank you for the opportunity to be heard on House File 37. As an independent insurance agent who helps employers navigate the workers' comp marketplace and an employer, I have a unique insight on today's topic. As an employer, I'm responsible for providing a safe working environment for my employees, and that's I'm held accountable by OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. And I'm also required to carry workers' compensation insurance for my employees as enforced by the Department of Labor and Industry. Together, those regulatory entities, along with the Department of Commerce, work with employers like myself and school districts to help protect our fellow Minnesotans while they're working. The system is fair because it's focused on the work environment that we employers control. COVID-19 is a difficult virus to trace back to its original contraction. If an employer follows all suggested CDC and MDH guidelines, then how can we presume that the virus is contracted at the workplace? When workers' compensation benefits are paid to employees for an incident that causes that employee to miss work, like previously stated, their experience modification factor is impacted, rightfully so. Another fair process that holds employers accountable for the work environment. Currently, workers' compensation policies do respond for workplace injuries as well as occupational diseases if proven that such is on the job. No presumptions needed. By expanding that presumption, this presumption to a non-healthcare or first responder industry, my fear is that this will set the precedent for further industries to want to follow suit and put an unfair financial strain on those that employ our fellow Minnesotans. As a certified school risk manager, I work with school districts throughout the year and support all that educators do for our children here in Minnesota, but I do not believe that altering the workers' compensation system is the solution. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Wojciak, for your testimony. Member questions, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question to Representative Hewitt in regards to the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council, who did not support this, as to why you would want to continue the hearing of this bill when they are usually the foremost experts in presenting to the legislature on what we should do regarding that board. So I'm curious as to why you decided to carry this bill without their permission or
Representative Hewitt.
Representative McDonald, to my knowledge, the Work Compensation Board did not vote on this today, and we have not heard their result yet. So I was told very positive things from my contacts on that board, and I'm surprised to hear that you're hearing something totally different, but to my knowledge, they did not vote today.
Representative McDonald.
Well, that is true, but they were not even aware. They do not support this bill, as far as I know, of my information. So. And even to bring it up on the committee without their even their acknowledgement or their support is a little troublesome. So I'm just curious about that. But more importantly, Representative Hewitt, the fact that the vaccine's out and according to the governor, the bulk of the educators will be vaccinated by just in the next few weeks here, maybe a month, and the fact that 93% contracted it outside the workplace, is this bill even necessary anymore?
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative McDonald, that 93% figure is, I would beg to say that's different. And, you know, we all got our facts and our stories and where they come from. But the statistics that even the state says, many of these people have contacted this on in their workplaces. And it's not a big amount. I mean, we're not talking, the total fiscal note on this is $624,000 for the whole state. And even the EMS workers and the nurses, it was somewhere lower than that even. So that's an approximate value, but our real value is coming back on nurses and high-end users. Nurses are high-end users, are not as big as we thought. And you're right, I mean, let's get people vaccinated, let's continue down that source, but we still need to make sure that our teachers feel comfortable getting back in the classroom, working with our students and keeping the schools open. Because my own district, which I also want to say that my school board members aren't here because they support this. My own district basically had to close down Rosemount High School after an outbreak of staff this fall. Our football team lost 3 games because of that. So we really need to look at, we hear stories of things coming in. We hear the virus is getting, that can get much worse. We need to be ready for that. All I'm asking is that we give our teachers a little thing in the back and say, hey, we got you if something happens to you. And again, this really is not, I would love to see the study of 93% because I've looked over all this and it's not there. And Mayo did that study, I believe, and they really haven't shared it with any of us. So that's interesting. So sorry, Representative McDonald, I disagree with you.
Representative McDonald.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hewitt, that's okay to disagree with me. I can disagree with you as well. And the fact that the Workers' Compensation Advisory Board, there is no peace in the valley yet. But we'll set that aside for another reason. You said that you want to make sure that teachers feel safe in school. Certainly, I do too. I know that many teachers in my district do feel safe in school and want to get back to school. But that said, our private schools and parochial schools and charter schools have been going since September. Those teachers have been safe. The kids have been safe. There's been no incidences. And they're leaps and bounds ahead of our public school kids because of that. Because distance learning is very difficult on our kids. I know it's difficult on my 15-year-old, and I'm sure it's difficult on anyone on this committee here or listening or watching that has kids that are distance learning. So we certainly want to make sure that it's safe. But this bill doesn't do that necessarily. And the fact that you retroactive back to July of last year, when most teachers were all distance learning, and for that matter, and it was in the summer. So why put that language in the bill that goes retro back to July of 2020? Just curious on that, Mr. Hewitt. Representative Hewitt.
Representative Hewitt, please be brief because we are past committee time right now. So if you could answer the question and briefly.
Yes, and thank you, Representative McDonald. The bottom line is that back then they didn't. We need to encompass all that. I lost my train of thought, and I know you're pushed for time here, Chair. But the truth is that we got to go back. We got to cover that time frame. And remember, that's where it was. Remember that this is not cut and dry. If these teachers were out partying the night before and nothing was hot at the school during that time, it's not going to be paid out. If they have a school that was hot and they got the infection at school, it's going to be proven. Even the presumption doesn't include that. I mean, you have to have some sort of situation that you can push at school. This is really a misnomer that just goes anywhere. So I need these falsehoods cleared up on this bill, and I'm sorry we don't have more time to talk about it, but Representative McDonald, I owe you a phone call anyways. We'll have a long talk.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Hewitt. Just for the record, though, our teachers are usually probably not out partying the night before. They're at home doing their homework, grading tests, and preparing for the next day and or the next sporting event. So just to let you know on that. But again, lastly, Mr. Chair, I know you want to move on. Our private schools have been open, and our teachers are feeling safe. They're doing good work. I want our teachers to feel safe. And I think you're right. This bill is not ready for prime time. And let's talk offline sometime, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. And I will clear up one thing that you said. My wife teaches at a parochial at a private school. That school was shut down in December due to positive COVID. So when you say there was no incidences, that is not true. And that is a small school with only 42 students in it. So they were shut down, and most of the school had to quarantine over the Christmas recess, which really wasn't real exciting for those elementary kids.
Duly noted, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Hewitt, final comments.
Mr. Chair, you said my final comment there. I had to clarify that as I was looking through my paperwork. So members, we're going to work on this. It's going to keep developing. I appreciate your time. I appreciate the lively debate. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing the bill today.
I will renew my motion that House File 37 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Members, we're a few minutes over. I did email Representative Raleigh during this time. We're going to do our best to get his bill scheduled. We did go over, and that's part of the challenges being on Zoom with 90 minutes to get these bills done. We have a busy schedule next week. If members have any quick questions, they can ask me. Otherwise, we are adjourned. Thank you for your attention.